Hello and welcome to the Son of a Ginger podcast. I am Mason Moreau, and sitting right next to me is Patrick Baylor.
Help me! Oh, sorry guys, I got eaten by a skull bear. That was
skull bear.
That was my voice trapped in the skull bear.
Yeah, you know those skull bears, they like to scream.
Yeah, you know, scream with the voice of who they kill.
Right.
A tease of what's in the film. So, as a little tease of what we're talking about today. Today on Son of a Ginger, we will be talking about Annihilation.
Did you see it? Probably not.
No, as I think that's one of the problems of it, but it is a cool original film. But Annihilation, directed by and written and directed by Alex Garland, famous for being the writer-director of Ex Machina and many other cool sci-fi related films that he's at least written.
Ex Machina.
And this stars Natalie Portman, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Tessa Thompson, Gina Rodriguez, and the always fun Oscar Isaac. And this is a strange, odd, but very, very original film. And this was written for the screen by Alex Garland, but it is adapted by a book, which is the first of the Southern Reach trilogy, authored by Jeff Vandermeer. And I think Alex Garland, he read this first book, got super jazzed about it, and then afterwards wrote a screenplay to adapt it.
He wrote the screenplay as well?
Yes, yeah. Like, adapted screenplay by Alex Garland.
Very nice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And yeah, this is a fun, cool, crazy movie. Mason, are you familiar with those books? Have you read any of those?
No, I haven't read a single one.
Well, we know one person that did, and that's Mr. Alex Garland. But I don't know too much about the books either, but I think he sticks pretty much to them. But the fact that this is a movie based off of the first book in a trilogy is interesting, but I don't think this movie is made to be a trilogy or like a multi episodic film series. A franchise is the proper term.
Yeah, I think if they had any intentions to make it into a franchise, those are pretty much squashed at this point.
Yes, they are. Yeah, because the bad thing about this film, it has a lot of good things, and we'll talk about the bad now because we have a lot of good to talk about a little bit later, but is the money and the distribution problems. So, you know, this had a budget of $40 million, and in its opening weekend, it made about $11 million. And I think in the United States has grossed $27 million. I'm not sure its figures in China, but yeah, this is a very unique film because of how weird it was and how odd it was and how differently it tested in test screenings. The financier, David Ellison from Paramount, told Scott Rudin, hey, we need to either make some changes or do something with distribution. So that's what he did. For international distribution, instead of it being in theaters, it released on Netflix 17 days later, I believe. So, If you're trying to watch it in the UK, you can do it easily, but you know, just with your Netflix subscription. And I think that's a shame because this is a movie that I really highly recommend seeing in a theater. We got to see it in a theater, and just sound design and visuals alone, I don't know why you'd want to see that on a small laptop.
Right. Yeah. I think this movie definitely should be enjoyed on a big screen, but the marketing of this movie did not hit the point at all. Like the trailer was, it made it seem a lot more like a by the numbers sci-fi thriller, with maybe some heady concepts. But all in all, like explaining this movie to people before they bought their ticket to go see it was done pretty poorly, and I think that definitely hasn't had an effect on its overall gross.
Yeah, because I mean, and that was David Ellison's like problem that he brought up, of that like, I'm not confident that this is going to excite or entice the average moviegoer. Like, this is fine for you and me. We're two definite nerds that enjoy a good sci-fi thing and a good heady sci-fi thing. But, you know, Jim Bob and Mary Ellen from, you know, wherever, flyover state, might just want to see some cool explosions, and you get some explosions in this, but there's a lot of thinking, and I don't know. For you know, a mainstream audience, the average, even the average American, and then let alone the average just moviegoer everywhere, it might be a little too smart for them. I don't know.
It seems to me like the business end of Hollywood is always aiming to please the bottom line.
And you were telling me Paramount wasn't really doing that, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, well, yeah, so this movie is actually the most recent in a string of financial failures from Paramount. I have a quote here from IndieWire that I took out of one of their articles. It says, nearly every Paramount release in 2017 was a financial loss, from Ghost in the Shell to Baywatch, Transformers The Last Knight, and Suburbicon. The Last Knight was the studio's top grosser in the U.S., but it made a franchise low with $130 million. Along with Daddy's Home 2, it was the only Paramount film to break $100 million domestically. So, Paramount has been losing the box office game recently, and so I think the difficulty of marketing this movie, paired with the anxiety that Paramount needs to put out something that's going to make them some money, just did not bode well for the success of this movie financially.
Yeah. And here's the unfortunate thing, though. Like, you list all those movies. Like, I'll say it first. I didn't see any of those movies because I don't think any of those movies were films that needed to be made. I don't think I needed to see a Baywatch movie. I don't think I needed to see Transformers 5 or 6 or whatever the heck they're up to now. But this is a movie that I think I'm glad that exists and is just wildly original for why it exists, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, let's just start talking about the film, because of those films that you listed, I think it's Paramount's biggest success in content wise, not financially, you know, of what they put on the screen. I'd say, yeah. Like, one last point, I guess I would compare this to how Blade Runner 2049 did. Another great sci-fi film that looks really cool, very heady, big concepts, but didn't do the best in the box office as well, because, again, could have been too smart for audiences. I don't know. But what was cool about this movie is it was just wholly original. I'll talk about the cast first. I think the only other sci-fi film I can think of that, like, you know, features women in such a great way is Alien.
Ghostbusters.
Yeah, exactly. Good film that features women in this way might be Alien, but like this one has just a badass quartet of women trying to figure some crap out. But yeah, Mason, also tell me what the film is about.
Okay, so it's about a researcher at, I believe it's Johns Hopkins.
Yes.
Yeah, so she's a professor at Johns Hopkins, played by Natalie Portman. She met her husband in the military. He was part of a secret operation that he couldn't tell her much about. He disappears for a year, and she thinks he's dead. She presumes he's dead, and she's like a cancer researcher, and she's all caught up in her work now because she's got nothing else to live for or whatever. One day her husband shows up on her doorstep, and she tries to get him to explain what happened to him, and he really can't. And he's being a little bit cryptic. He's acting not like himself. And then all of a sudden he like spits blood into his water glass and says, "I'm not feeling good." And they rush him in an ambulance. The ambulance gets taken by the government, and Natalie Portman and her husband get taken off to a secret base outside of this crazy anomaly called the Shimmer. Okay, so the Shimmer, this thing called the Shimmer, it basically looks like, here's what I'm going to say. You know when you were a kid and you had bubbles?
Yes.
And then the like there would be like a little film on top of the bubbles that had like a whole bunch of lights or like that had this weird like Technicolor like sort of coloring to it.
A little rainbow reflection, something like that to it. Yeah, 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 okay.
So it basically looks like that. It looks like this little swirl of all these different colors that are like overlaid over what's in the background.
That's a good way to describe it. This undescribable, very visually appealing thing. But yeah, they go to the Shimmer.
Even the design of what this thing called the Shimmer is a little bit abstract. And I think that's this overarching theme of the movie is abstraction. You find out about this thing called the Shimmer. And when we were watching it in the theater, I turned to you and I was like, I'm going to make the call now. This thing called the Shimmer is planet cancer. Because you see as the movie moves through, cancer is such a big, big, heavy thematic element in the movie. Is it, you know, Natalie Portman's researching cancer. Jennifer Jason Leigh, spoiler, has cancer. The other lady who befriends Natalie Portman, her daughter, died of cancer. So it's like, I had to guess that this is some sort of cancer for Earth.
And you hit it right on the nose. And I remember you telling me that, and I had that in the back of my mind, and as the film went, like, I just kept thinking about that, and it just made a lot of sense. So they see the Shimmer, and they see that, okay, this is messing some stuff up with nature, and all of the people, all the researchers that we've had that have gone in there haven't made it back out alive or just haven't made it back out. So these four women, Natalie Portman, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Tessa Thompson, and Gina Rodriguez, who are like a bevy of like different occupations. I believe Tessa Thompson's a paramedic, and Gina Rodriguez is like she's not a biologist. No, what does she
do? She's a physicist.
So they all go in and figure out what the heck's happening. I believe they're the first women to do so as well. And I don't the women thing. Oh, and then there's one other gal that goes in, but again, spoilers. She's in there for maybe 2 minutes, and then she gets killed. So sorry for this.
She's the genesis of probably one of the scariest scenes in a movie that I've seen in a while.
Yeah, and so here's why this film works. So we just essentially explained to you the first act, and the first act is this mystery of like, okay, well, what's happening? What's happening with Oscar Isaac? I'm going to start calling them by their character names. What's happening with Kane, and how can we solve it? And then they see this problem, and now they go in. And the second act, where they're essentially in the Shimmer and traveling through, it's half adventure but half horror film, or thriller, I guess. And I haven't been that scared and on the edge of my seat in the theater, because what works about this film is, so what the Shimmer does essentially is it blends DNA together. It makes stuff shift and refract, if that's the proper term.
Right.
And so that makes plants have the cellular structure of people. Like, you'll see plants grow like how a person is supposed to grow. You'll see deer and goats and flowers like all meshed into one strange looking organism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like the way that I could think about explaining it, or explaining what the Shimmer does, so when you think about cancer, it's when your cells basically lose the ability to know when to stop replicating, right? So they lose that understood. They lose that understood way of knowing when to stop communicating and create this huge problem. So basically the Shimmer is that, but with everything. It's the way we understand how the Earth works, losing its ability to understand how it itself works.
Exactly.
And so from there you see an alligator that has rows of teeth like a shark. You see people who have died and turned into plants. You see lots of people's different DNAs getting merged into one person.
Yeah, and what works with this film, so like we're now talking about this strange body horror, essentially. Like,
yeah.
Well, and that's the thing, it goes into body horror, because first it's just like, oh, wow, an alligator with shark teeth. That's kind of scary. I wonder how that happens. And as they get closer and closer, it just gets more intense and scarier. They find video of people that used to be there, like the past researchers.
Oh, shit, I forgot about that.
Which includes Kane, played by Oscar Isaac. And we see videos of their past research, and one of the most intense and just gut-wrenching scenes is they open up this guy's stomach and you see his guts moving like a snake or just something else,
mm-hmm.
where like everything is inside his belly moving around, and that's where things start to get crazy and the film really turns on its head of what it is, of this, oh crap, what's happening? I'm scared as crap. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, and then they later find this guy who is on the video footage that they found in, like, an emptied out swimming pool. And it's, like, it's this weird, like, yellow and green and blue mold that's been incorporated into his skeleton. And he looks like he just exploded, it looks like he just exploded mold. And it honestly looked like a modern art piece.
It was beautiful.
It was beautiful. And so that's one of the things about this movie, is that it's equal parts beautiful and chilling. And it sort of parallels that the understanding that life itself and the way life works is that as well.
It's chaotic. It's beautiful and strange.
It's beautiful chaos.
Definitely. And with the visuals, that's what, like, I would say this film also shows, because it's definitely, you can see how much it is made by just a person with a lot of ideas that is like, what if we mesh these two things together? And instead of like, what I remember, Spy Kids. Remember Spy Kids 2?
Yeah. I definitely remember that movie.
Remember Spy Kids 2, how it had like some different animals merged together into like one other weird animal?
Yeah, by Steve Buscemi.
Yeah, and it reminded me a lot of that, except this was done way better. Because, oddly enough, that's what some of the animals in this film are. You know, like, they're just these crazy, weird mergings of animals whose DNA, like, go together. And so there's some things that are beautiful, like the plants and those goats. But I think the scariest thing in the film is this bear that has a skull that, what else does it have? It had, like, a bunch of different animals in it.
It's a bear. So online I heard people are comparing it to Man Bear Pig. which is really funny, because
from South Park, correct?
It sort of does look like that. Yeah. I could describe it with like a bear as a bear with like an exposed skull.
With an exposed skull and then some other animals in there. But what is the scariest thing is, and the film uses it well, it picks up on how all the animals' DNAs are constantly changing and constantly merging. So this bear, you know, it eats one of the first characters. I'll tell you the actress's name because that's fair to her. It eats Tuva Novotny's character, Cass Shepard, eats her, and she screams when she gets killed. So later this bear shows up, and in its roar, you hear that scary roar that I did earlier, but then you also hear the echoes of Shepard just screaming in terror as she is killed. That crap was scary, dude.
Right, and it serves as a way to move the plot along, or the sequence along as well, because they think that they're hearing their friends screaming for help, and one of the girls runs for it, and the bear ends up, like, ripping off her jaw.
Oh, yeah.
Which was so ridiculous. Like, I saw that, and I was like, ooh! You know, you sometimes in movies...
Dude, it was hard to watch.
Like, crazy, crazy, gross, gory stuff. And, you know, up until that point, the movie wasn't that gory. You know, like, it was... There was some body horror stuff with the organs and cutting open the dude's stomach. But you didn't just see a feral screaming creature just claw someone's, like, face away. But it was gross.
Yeah. And so, yeah, the film, at this point, it just works because, like everyone's DNA, this film is constantly changing. So, yeah, by this point, it's this big, terrifying monster film at this point. And it only keeps shifting. Because now we see all these crazy DNA-changing animals, and now we kind of really get into the science fiction, like the fiction, science fiction of it all. We try to learn it. We try to get it explained to us. Jennifer Jason Leigh does an okay job in it. And then they start talking about the cancer. But towards the end of the film is where it just becomes a visual wonder. And we try to understand how things are happening.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think the first act sort of builds this mystery. The second act plays around in that mystery. It sort of shows you what this thing can do, what it can create, what the stakes are here. And then in the third act, it's the payoff. We're going to show you what you need to figure out what this thing is, but we're not going to figure it out for you, essentially.
Yeah.
Which is what I like about this movie a lot, is it doesn't treat its viewer like an idiot. You know, there's not constant flashbacks to things that happened in the past so that they make sure that you understand that. Except, you know...
There are flashbacks, like, though. It's a thing.
They're flash-forwards.
No, there's flashbacks and forwards, man.
There are a lot of flashbacks.
We change around in time, but here's the thing. They don't flashback every possible thing. Yeah. They let us know about the basics of what we need to know about Lena. Like, we don't have flashbacks for Jennifer Jason Leigh or Tessa Thompson or anyone like that. We learn about Natalie Portman's past, and then we find out about every other character's past through just dialogue. And here's why this film did kind of good. You say it didn't treat the viewer like an idiot. It did still do some explanation and some important building, because this is a totally new original film, new sci-fi film, so there was some successful exposition throughout, and that was mostly in the beginning, and then towards the end is where you have to do some figuring out. And this ending, you know, really reminds me of a lot of other sci-fi films where you gotta kind of do some thinking at the end, in that, you know, Inception, for example, comes to mind. It's a very indifferent, ambiguous ending. That's the better word. But let's figure out how do we get there.
With Inception, there's two arguments. Is Cobb in a dream, or is he in real life? With this movie, every other person I've talked to about this movie has had a slightly different theory about what this thing is. So that's like... That's what's unique about this movie, is it gives you the tools to create the meaning of the movie yourself.
Yeah, and so let's get to this ending. Let's explain how we get to it and then discuss it. So Dr. Ventress, Jennifer Jason Leigh, you know, she reveals that she has cancer, and I think Natalie Portman figures out. Regardless, we know that she has cancer, and we know that Jennifer Jason Leigh wants to figure out how everything's happening. And it's a bit of a suicide mission, essentially. So she goes to the center. She goes to the lighthouse, which is the center of the shimmer, where in the beginning of the film we see a meteor crash into it, which starts it all. And then we figure out what things are, but we don't necessarily figure out what things are. But we see what happens. So we go in. We see some past video footage, which continues to document Kane, Oscar Isaac's character. And this is where we see that Kane, actual Kane, explodes himself He kills himself. However, then we see a duplicate of Kane dip out and leave. We see that, and we see his dead body. Then Natalie Portman goes on into the center of this thing, and we just see 5 minutes of amazing visuals. I'll still, like, this scene where she goes into the center of the shimmer might be one of the my favorite things, or at least the coolest things I've seen on screen. Like, we talked about jaw flooring in our Blade Runner podcast. My floor was on the jaw. Floor jaw. You know?
My floor was on the jaw.
My jaw was on the floor. Yeah, exactly. But I was floor jawed by this sequence. Because it's Jennifer Jason Lee gets duplicated, I believe. And then what happens? She gets unduplicated or something?
She essentially didn't explain it to you.
Yeah, I think she becomes part of the shimmer. And then Natalie Portman just looks on into it. And then some of her DNA, like some blood comes out. And then through that DNA, it creates a copy of her. Or at least the shimmer now starts to copy her.
It basically creates a life-size Monopoly token version of her.
At least that's what it begins to be. And it,
yeah, that's what it looks like.
Yeah, and it starts to become this cool CGI, token of her that is constantly replicating and learning to be her. And then they begin to fight because it's Natalie Portman kind of just fighting it, and it is trying to duplicate what she is doing, so it just mirrors her action. And Natalie Portman figures out how to end this by finding another grenade that in Oscar Isaac's dead body, on his suit or whatever, finds another flash grenade and pulls it off and gives it to her copy, which then it continues to duplicate itself, and then duplicate like what's happening with this grenade, and then it begins to set itself on fire. Is what I got out of it. Of
yeah.
What I saw. So, and then
it's in like some baby stages of learning how to. Well, it keeps doing the opposite thing to her. So, like, when she tries to run away, it grabs her. When she, like, I don't know. It was weird. It's hard to explain it.
Yeah. So, let's try to explain it. So, the last shot is Natalie Portman comes back. She's talking with Benedict Wong, who is another scientist in the film. And the film goes back and forth with asking, well, what did you do? What happened? Type of thing, which I enjoyed as a narrative device. But the last shot of the film is Natalie Portman giving Oscar Isaac a hug. We got out of this, but then we see Oscar Isaac. I'm doing air quotes, but you can't see that. Oscar Isaac, who we already know from that video, is actually a copy from The Shimmer. Give Natalie Portman a hug. His eyes flash like this orange type of thing signifying it, and then her eyes have a little shimmery flash suggesting
they both have shimmery flashy eyes for some reason
suggesting she could be a copy from The Shimmer. So you've talked about with friends, I've talked about with friends. Mason, what the hell happened in the end?
I refuse to interpret that part of the movie.
Why?
Because,
dude, we're podcasting about it. Interpret the hell out of it. Do it.
Okay. No. I don't feel like that was meant to be in the movie. I feel like that was put in the movie by Paramount to have some sort of ambiguous ending that leaves questions. But there were already way too many questions. We didn't need that. I resent that part of the movie.
Dude, I thought it was great because I think it was a smart business choice if that was a Paramount choice, but that wasn't a Paramount choice. Because if Paramount had it their way, it wouldn't be ambiguous. It would be, here's what happened, and now we're going to make two more movies and have big financial success. No, this is the ending that Scott Rudin and Alex Garland kind of fought for and made sure they kept, and why this film sadly isn't in more theaters. But, I mean, what I got out of it is I think it is not a copy of Natalie Portman. I think Natalie Portman, though, her DNA was so warped and twisted that there's now, like, definitely some shimmer in her DNA.
You definitely know there's shimmer in her DNA because she was looking at it in a microscope.
But more so, is she the shimmer, you know? I guess that's what the ending asks. But so you refuse to answer because you don't like how damn ambiguous it is?
No, I don't. Like, I think that it's just it was a bad choice to end it that way. It's pretty clear to me that, like, you watch the Natalie Portman character escape, and you see her with her comrade's tattoo on her arm, and
that,
so,
that
like,
she
to,
developed
to me,
in the shimmer, though. Remember that?
Yeah, to me, it was pretty clear that the real Natalie Portman was the one that escaped, and then you see her have these shimmery eyes and hug Oscar Isaac character, and all of a sudden, she's not a shimmery, she might be a copy, when there's nothing else in the movie that might point to that. You know, it seems so clear that Natalie Portman, the real Natalie Portman character, what was her name?
Lena.
It seems so clear that the real Lena escaped. So, and there was nothing, there's no evidence to the contrary.
Interesting.
So it seemed like they just put that in there to be like, ooh, maybe she's this. But in a movie that was so smart about what it shows you and what it doesn't, that just seemed like a really dumb choice to me.
So, I mean, I thought it was a fun way to end things. But so here's the thing, Mason. You have your soapbox. You have your platform that is the Son of a Ginger podcast. How would have you liked things to end? Okay.
So for the ending I would have liked to see in this movie would have been Natalie Portman's character, Lena, finally owning up to the fact that she cheated on her husband and drove him away, because it's revealed in the movie that that's why Kane ends up taking on this mission of going into the Shimmer, because he's so hurt by the fact that his wife was cheating on him. And I would have liked to see Natalie Portman's character try to apologize or own up to what she did that drove him away and caused him to, you know, pull this phosphor grenade. I mean, the phosphor grenade, that reason, like, her cheating on him isn't really what caused that. But, you know, I would have liked to see her try and apologize and then realize that it's too late. Or realize that, you know, he himself is already gone, and she tried to go through this thing to save him, but it was ultimately her actions that were his downfall and her downfall and their marriage's downfall. That doesn't pertain to the whole movie, but I think at that point, by that, like, those 2 minutes of the ending, we got enough of what we needed from the Shimmer to glean everything we needed to know to make our own ideas about it. So just giving the time to wrap up the more human story that's inside this giant sci-fi thriller would have been a satisfying ending for me.
Okay. I mean, that's fair. I mean, the thing that you said, you would like things to be wrapped up, and you think it is clear that it is still Natalie Portman. I'm just going to say a couple of things just to honestly play devil's advocate. Because there were some shots in there that showed the refraction on the water glass that suggests that she also could be a copy, in the same way that happened earlier in the film when Oscar Isaac first appears. As he's drinking water from the glass, the water refracts down. So that's something I just want to bring up just to cover all of our bases. But yeah, I think what works about this ending is, I feel like this is the exciting part of cinema. You and I are still talking about it, still trying to wrap our brains about it, and figure out what the hell happened.
Yeah, but I would have still been talking about it and wrapping my brain around it, even if that ending didn't happen. You know, like I said, there's enough in that full 2.5 hours of movie to get my brain going without needing that little eye shimmery ending.
But now it's added us to talking about this thing, I think, 2 or 3 weeks after we initially saw it? Because I just remember when we did see it, we both sat outside the theater, and for about a few minutes, we just both kind of sat there in silence, just trying to figure out, oh my gosh, man, what did we just watch?
It was like 15 minutes of sitting outside the theater in pretty much silence, aside from the occasional, I don't know what this meant, or I don't know what this meant.
I think there's a few sentences I remember where I was just trying to be like, well, what about the, and then the, but, oh, gotcha, well, the type of stuff, you know.
It was basically just both of us thinking out loud.
Yeah, and then we wait like a week or so after to still hope we can have a more refined answers to record for all you listeners out there. But hopefully we're given a refined answer. The last thing I do want to touch about that we talked about a little bit in the beginning is, I guess, like the big theme that this film tries to talk about, which is cancer, self-destruction, I guess, and what it brings, why it necessarily exists. And I think this film brought up an interesting point of saying, well, what if this self-destruction is for good? What if, like, it's important because this resetting of DNA makes this cooler looking stuff, and I don't know. Makes stuff cooler looking, at least.
It's what if this is good because it makes the flower people?
It makes the flower people look cool, man. Oh, but you know, what if this reset that this alien shimmer DNA? I guess it's an alien. That's another thing that neither of us are totally sure of. That I think it's an alien. Well, essentially, so why? If it is an alien, why is it bringing this upon us? Is it doing it to repopulate the Earth to make it livable for this an alien species? Is it improving upon itself because it's saying, hey, the human world and human nature is already somewhat destructive, so we are going to do the same as the people do and destroy it. However, what we are going to do is improve it, make improvements to it, mm-hmm. by combining DNA that works and then phasing out the bad and then making some how they want to be. Because all the main characters that I've listed earlier, they have a different form of self-destruction that they show in their characters. And Tessa Thompson, who plays Radek, you know, she is someone that that is very depressed. She cuts herself. And however, as the film goes, she embraces the shimmer and lets it kind of take its course to make her who she believes is her best self, and that is a flower person.
Well, there's just a beautiful scene in the movie where you see these little sprouts growing from the cuts on her arms, and then she walks away and ends up becoming, it's like, they're not really flower people because they don't have, like, they're not,
they're flowers.
They're not organically alive anymore. They're just,
well, they are, but they're flowers with the cellular structure of people. Like, it's like,
yeah. They're plants with the cellular structure of people. Yeah, that's.
Cellular structure in that, like, it's not necessarily a skeleton, but, like, if you were to see my body, like, a normal human body shape, just imagine that replaced with roots and flowers for the listeners at home that haven't seen the film yet or know exactly what I'm talking about.
I mean, if you're still listening to this and you haven't seen the movie yet, then we've spoiled too much. And
way too much. But, yeah, now we're just trying to make sense of everything. But so, Mason, so based on what I just said, how do you feel? Do you think they achieve what they're trying to say with self-destruction and cancer? Do you think that you can, like, necessarily learn or become improved by it? Maybe that's why cancer exists is another thing. Is that why it necessarily exists on the cellular level? It's supposed to improve upon yourself, but then our body responds by saying, oh, this is killing us. Stop it. Again, I think I'm getting out of the science and now just getting into some crazy philosophy right now.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, the fact that I brought up that this thing was Earth cancer was sort of stems from that idea. Like, that's sort of is what I saw in this movie, is that this shimmer thing could technically just be a natural occurrence in nature. Because, you know, nature expands outside of our planet and, like, understandably encapsulates all of, like, the whole universe, right?
Yes.
So this thing very much could be a meteorite that just lands on Earth and creates this anomaly that changes the structure and what we understand about how things work. And it's a random event. It could happen to any planet, and it changes how that planet works. And so you talk to people who have had cancer, who have survived cancer, and they say that when they survived it, it changed their personality. It changed who they were at the core, from whatever it may be, the radiation, from what part of their body was affected by the cancer. But
makes you become self-reflective. Yeah.
Well, it makes you become self-reflective, but also it genuinely changes your personality. Like some people have higher temper after cancer and during radiation. So and that carries on into the rest of their life. Like from post-cancer, they just get angry a lot easier. So yeah, I think that the abstract idea of this shimmer thing is that it's there to be a reset button for the planet, a random reset for the planet.
As that's what cancer is. Cancer is very random and can happen randomly. Like to get a little bit personal here, yeah, my mom recently survived breast cancer, and I would attribute something very close to what you said, that I think she did come out a different person, learned about herself, I think became a stronger woman out of it, as many do coming out of cancer. And I think we see the same thing with our characters, in that we see how the shimmer, our cancer, so to speak, in the film affects and teaches them. So like Tessa Thompson, she becomes positive and accepting of it. And she feels like it's meant to be. That's something that you see with not necessarily cancer survivors, but people that have cancer that kind of accept it and learn about themselves and sadly pass. Then you see others learn about it and get angry. Kind of like Gina Rodriguez's character, and denies it. And then and then you have Jennifer Jason Leigh, who like accepts it, but then just kind of does a bit of a, whatchamacallit, like a bit of a bucket list type of thing of like, okay, well, I'm going to finish my stuff out.
Well, she's just basically accepted the fact that she's going to die.
Yeah. And then so those are the people that I guess represent the folks that don't necessarily survive it. But then we have Oscar Isaac and Natalie Portman, who I guess do. And Oscar Isaac, you see, is this changed man, because he is a changed man, because he's not him. Ah!
Speaking on that, little tidbit, if you notice in that last piece of footage that Oscar Isaac's character films, he's speaking with a southern accent. And that's because he's taken on the southern accent of one of his fallen comrades.
Yeah, and it like combines. Are you saying copied shimmer Oscar Isaac has those in?
I'm saying regular Oscar Isaac has a southern accent when he's filming.
Yeah, dude, there's so much to unpack.
Copied Oscar Isaac does not have that southern accent, but Natalie Portman, she has her comrade's tattoo on her arm, so that is more proof that Natalie Portman is the real version of herself, and Oscar Isaac's character is the copy.
Gotcha. So, and that's the thing. So, I guess, like, to button this cancer thing, Natalie Portman's character, I love that we just keep calling him by their actor's name.
Yeah. They don't call him by their names enough in the movie to really, like...
And Natalie Portman is way more recognizable than Lena. But Lena comes back out of it alive, and I think she's one of those people that is more so, she's a survivor through and through. She lets you know she survives. She has literally her battle wounds and battle scars, and this cancer is literally a part of her with, you know, that little shimmer thing. But she comes out of it alive and I think learns from it. That we don't know what happens, you know, necessarily after that big hug. But that's what I'd like to think, is that, you know, she learns from it and she becomes a better woman. She also goes to her flashbacks and figures that she learns. Batman, we learned a lot about ourselves as we watch this film.
Sure.
And this was definitely a thinker. And that's why I like this film. So it didn't do well critically, or it didn't do well financially. It did okay critically. Who cares, man? This was a good original film, and that's why I like this. This wasn't Star Wars Episode 100. This wasn't Avengers 19. This was, hey, this is adapted from this cool book that the writer-director read, and then he went off and made something fun.
It was Annihilation, one and only.
And I like that. I like a film that ends, and like, you know, we mentioned Inception, for example. We're not going to get an Inception 2. I'm happy that we're not going to get an Annihilation 2. We're not going to get an Arrival 2. You know, a film that's similar to that, that, you know, I also thought of a lot of philosophical things after the film.
Yeah, maybe we'll get a Dunkirk 2, but we'll see.
But it has
I'm
done
just
it.
I'm just kidding. I'm totally kidding.
But, dude, it has done in the name, so you know it's done.
It's done, Kirk.
So overall, I'm happy that this film exists. And on the bright side, for the people that are in the UK and other places that are going to get this film on Netflix, you do get to see it early and with a Netflix subscription. But if you can put it on a big-ass TV or a big projector, I highly recommend watching this movie that way. Because, like I said, visually stunning. Cool film.
It has good sights and sounds that are meant to be appreciated on a surround sound and in very high detail.
Yeah. So MoviePass helped us out again. Thanks, MoviePass.
Episode inadvertently brought to you by MoviePass.
Because we're able to see all these movies because we already paid for them in a monthly subscription, where technically this film becomes $2. But hey, I still get a lot of popcorn at the end and don't make any money back anyway. So Mason, I've been talking a lot, telling you all my crazy thoughts, but in 30 seconds or less, I mean, how do you feel about this film? What does it speak to you? What did you get out of it?
I think that movies like this, or this movie and movies like this, are my favorite kind of movie. It has completely stuck with me since I saw it, still thinking about it every day since I saw it. You know, at least once I kind of think about it in some capacity. And that's sort of the highest praise I could give a movie, I feel. Because when the movie starts to exist outside of the theater, that's when you know it's something that is that has had a long-lasting effect on you. So, bravo to Annihilation. I really enjoyed it. I had two problems with it, which are the ending and Jennifer Jason Leigh's performance. It was very wooden. They sort of explain why she's acting like that, but it's still pretty wooden.
It's a choice that, you know, she made that works, I guess. But here's the thing, like, I'm not the biggest Jennifer Jason Leigh fan. I would have rather seen some of the other actresses that I saw that were also auditioned for the role. Tilda Swinton, Allison Janney, I think Laurie Metcalf. You know, that the type of, like, strong female actor in her late 40s, early 50s. Tilda Swinton would have been an entirely different movie, though.
Yeah, I think Tilda Swinton would have pulled it off pretty well.
That's the thing. She disappears into her role, so she can disappear into a fairly normal-looking, normal-acting psychologist. But Jennifer Jason Leigh, she gets the job done, you know. She passes still, you know. She gets a passing grade. Maybe not an A+, but a B? Question mark?
Yeah, B-. B-.
Sure. But
I give the movie an A+.
Hell yeah, man. Well, let's end on a positive note. Yeah, like I said, this is a cool film. Highly recommend seeing it in a theater. But I highly recommend seeing it if you can't see it in a theater, because it's one that will make you think afterwards. And speaking of thinking, Mason, I think we're about done over here.
Yeah, I think we're going to wrap up now. If you want to check us out, go to sonofaginger.buzzsprout.com. We're available on Apple Podcasts, soon to be available on everywhere you get your podcasts. Please hit that subscribe button if you like what you're hearing, and have a great day of watching movies. Don't get annihilated.
Do not get annihilated, and don't get refracted. Thank you all. I'm your host, Patrick Bailey.
And I've been Mason Moran.
Thank you for listening.